Good evening. It is good to be with you all. I appreciate Dylan for leading those songs. It's like he read my outline for this morning and this night. Yeah, I don't think you could possibly know how well those songs fit with what we're going to talk about today. And so thank you for leading those songs. I appreciate the prayer that was led earlier as well. In remembrance of those who have suffered in the recent tragedies and disasters. We began this morning asking the question, why? Why does that happen? Why does God let those kinds of things happen? Why does he let a shooter kill 58 people and injure almost 500? Why does he let hurricanes destroy homes and lives? Why does he let earthquakes do the same thing? Why is there pain and suffering? And we focus this morning on the fact that evil is a necessary potential. Not that it has to happen, but it has to be possible for it to happen, for good and love to be real. We talked about how love is only meaningful if you can choose to give it. One of the illustrations I meant to use, but forgot to use here, was if you consider a set of computers. And you could program those computers to be nice to each other, to say nice things and have a dialogue back and forth. But are those computers expressing love and compassion for each other? Well, no. They're merely created and following the instructions you gave them. And that was kind of our point, that for us to really have love and for love to be real, there has to be potential to not love. And God wanted us to have the freedom to choose love or not choose love, to choose good or not choose love, choose good. And that means we can choose to do evil. I don't know if you found that as a satisfying answer to that question. There are some other answers. And tonight, what we discuss, it will affect that as well. The answers we give tonight will relate to the question of evil, but we're going to focus on the other half of the problem, which is suffering. Now, lots of evil causes suffering. For instance, the Vegas shooting has caused much suffering for the families of those who've been impacted. Even complete strangers who've seen this event. But what about the natural disasters that you can't tie back to someone's evil choice? What about the events that you cannot tie back to a direct choice someone made? The hurricanes, the earthquakes, the volcanoes. Why doesn't God stop those? And again, we summed up the issue in three statements, that the reason this we wrestle with this idea is we believe, and the Bible teaches, God is all-powerful. He can do anything inside his universe. He's in complete control. But he's also all-good. And yet, evil exists. How do those three statements all remain true is the problem we face. How can that all be true? And what many people who are atheists or don't believe in God says, well, your God can't be all good and all powerful because of the evil in the world. There's no way. You got to give up one of those. And we spent some time realizing that when we say God can do anything, we have to be thoughtful about what we mean by that, since there are certain things, like lying, that God cannot do. But I also wanted to ask the question tonight as we begin talking about this. Is it always good to remove suffering? Is it always good to remove pain? Because, in fact, God created our bodies to feel pain. And there are people who have a disease that doesn't allow them to feel pain. And I read a little story about a girl who had all of her teeth taken out because she couldn't feel it when she bit her tongue. And they were scared she was going to bite her tongue off because she couldn't feel pain. When you put your hand on the hot stove, it hurts. But imagine if it didn't hurt. What would occur? You burn your hand off. Or even if you think about exercise, which often isn't very pleasant for some people, it can be very painful to exercise, and yet we exercise because if we don't, our bodies, these machines we call our bodies, will break down. Medical procedures often are very painful, but we do them because they are helpful. And so, as we think about that, as we start this conversation, we realize Removing the pain is not always the actual good thing to do. And it's a small piece of our answer to how can God be good and yet allow suffering to exist? Why don't you go to the book of Job? Job, there's two big questions being asked. The first one is, will mankind serve God for no reason? Will mankind serve God if he gets no benefit from it whatsoever? That's the challenge Satan lays against mankind. In fact, when you open up in chapter 1, look at verse 6. We meet Job in the first 5 verses. He's a very wealthy man. He has 10 children. And he's very devout. And so in verse 6 says, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. When I read this, I almost see Satan sauntering into God's throne room, successfully causing mankind to fall from God, successfully getting wickedness so prevalent, God actually destroys almost all of humanity. He says, from that place that you made that now is under my control. Seems to be his attitude. And one of the reasons I think that the attitude Satan has is because of what God says in verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Satan's statement seems to be a challenge, and God takes up the challenge and says, well, have you thought about Job? And you can almost see the grin fall off Satan's face. God says, for there's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge, a wall about him, and his house and all that he has on every side? You've protected everything he has. You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions. You have increased and have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face. Satan says, the only reason Job pays attention to you, the only reason Job cares about you, is because you've given him all this stuff. And you've protected him from suffering and from pain. You take away that stuff, he will curse you to your face. That's the challenge. And what God says in verse 12 is, okay, try it. Just don't touch his body. And what you read in the next couple of verses, 13 through 19, is that in 4 events, Satan sends people. He sends the Sabians to take he kills the servants and attack and take the donkeys and oxen. He sends fire to kill the sheep and the servants in verse 16. Verse 17, the Chaldeans steal the camels and kill the servants. In verse 18, he sends a windstorm to destroy the house that Job's 10 children are eating in. And one after another, a single servant escapes to tell Job what happened. In a matter of minutes, it says before the last servant is done speaking, the next one shows up. Job has learned he's lost everything, including his children. This is something significant about the issue of suffering, particularly at the topic that we're considering tonight. As you look at the story, and it illustrates that at least at this point, and there's a question mark that I have, is can Satan still do this? But at this point in history, Satan has enough power to control weather. He calls fire out of the sky to kill the sheep and these people. He sends a windstorm to destroy Job's children. He also is able to influence people to go and do his work. And what it says is that when we face suffering, Satan may be the cause. Now, we will never know. Job doesn't know. In fact, in the whole conversation that follows, Job and his friends never mention Satan or a character like him. But it illustrates that we need to recognize Satan might have a hand in the sufferings that occur. But what Job does is amazing. Because if you look in verse 20, the Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshipped. I don't know if that is your natural inclination when you lose absolutely everything you have. To fall down and worship God. But that's what Job does. That accusation, he will curse you to your face. And Job proves Satan wrong. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all of this, Job did not sin nor blame God. Satan shows up again. God asks the same question, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan comes with a new accusation. He's like, you let me touch his life. You let me take his health. He will curse you. God says, okay, but don't kill him. And so Satan sends a disease upon Job. And to the point, his wife comes out and says, why don't you just curse God and die? And he won't do it. But I want you to look at how Job feels about all of this by chapter 3. End of chapter 2, his three friends show up and spend a week in silence with him. In chapter 3, Job begins to speak. It says, afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Job says, I wish I was never born. The entirety of chapter 3 is him saying, it would have been better for me to have died in the womb, to have never seen the light of day, than to have gone through what I've gone. Some of you may feel the way Job feels at times. Some of you may know exactly how Job feels. The agonizing pain that overwrites the joys in his heart. This Job was, I wish I was never born. It would have been better. And after he gets done with this, Eliphaz, the first friend who speaks up, but if you look at verse 7, you get a summary of what each of the three friends are going to tell Job. They say in chapter 4, verse 7, or Eliphaz does, remember now, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. In brief, he's saying, Job, what terrible thing did you do that made God punish you in this way? He's saying bad things only ever happen to bad people. The fancy term for this is judgment theology. We know that that's not the case. We know, in fact, it's because of Job was good that the bad things happened to Job in this case. But Eliphaz says, what terrible thing did you do to deserve this? And Job's basic response, you can look at chapter 6, verse 24. This is a typical kind of response he gives, because each of the three friends says basically the same thing. Different words, but they're saying the same thing to Job. Job, what terrible thing did you do? And Job says in verse 24 of chapter 6, teach me and I will be silent. Show me how I've erred. How painful are honest words, but what does your argument prove? Do you intend to prove my words when the words of one despaired belong to the wind? You would even cast lots for the orphans and barter over your friend. Now please look at me and see if I lie to your face. Desist now, let there be no injustice. Even desist, my righteousness is yet in it. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? In short, Job's saying, I haven't done anything I can think of. I haven't done anything that would make God so angry at me to do all of this. That's what I don't understand. And this conversation continues essentially in this basic format, where Job says, you friends should be consoling me, and yet you're charging me. Tell me what I did. I can't think of anything. And Job says a couple times in chapter 13, but go to chapter 23, because I am done with you. I want to talk to God. I want my day in court with God. I will defend my case. I will prove my innocence. And God will vindicate me. And he says in verse 1, then Job replied, even today my complaint is rebellion. His hand is heavy despite my groaning. Oh that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn the words which he would answer and perceive what he would say to me. He would contend with me by the greatness of his power. Would he contend with me by the greatness of his power? No, surely he would pay attention to me. There the upright would reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. There's a lot of people in history who felt this way. They wanted their day in court with God. They wanted to challenge God and make their case. Unlike most of those people, Job gets that chance. If you jump to chapter 38, God shows up in a whirlwind, which is interesting considering how he says God will not challenge him with his might. God shows up in a whirlwind and begins asking Job some questions. He says in verse 2, "Who is this that darkens counsel without knowledge, by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me." God says, "Okay, Job, you ready? You teach me. I'm going to ask you some questions. You tell me how this works." And what is interesting is if you read chapters 38 through chapter 41, God asks a bunch of questions, and yet none of them have to do with Job's questions. Because Job is asking about the justice of receiving the treatment he's gotten. About how it's not fair. He's saying the moral and the supernatural meanings of suffering. And yet what God talks about, he says in verse 4, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" Verse 8. "Or who enclosed the sea with doors?" Verse 12. "Have you ever commanded in your life the morning?" Verse 19, "Where is the way of the dwelling of light, or to the dwelling of light, and the darkness, where is its place?" Verse 25, "Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt?" Verse 31, "Can you bind the chains of Pleiades," which is the constellations? And then at the end of chapter 38, he's talking about animals, and how they give birth, and how they eat, and how they're taken care of. He says, "Job, explain to me how all of this works." Which is really odd to me, because Job's talking about spiritual things. And God begins saying, "Tell me about the physical creation." In chapters 40 and 41, he uses two animals, the behemoth and the leviathan, which I personally believe to be descriptions of dinosaurs. He's the best explanation of those. He says, "Can you control these animals? Do you challenge these animals? Why would you challenge the Creator?" And this is a little baffling, because these are physical things. So what's the point? Why does God talk about this when Job's conundrum is the suffering he's undergoing? And what I finally realized is the implicit statement God's making. So Job, explain to me how the physical universe works. The universe that you can see and you can touch and you can hear. Explain to me how that works. But you can't do that. Then why do you think you'd be able to fully understand and explain how the spiritual universe works? Why do you think that you would be able to fully control and comprehend these spiritual questions you're asking? And there is the statement that he's essentially making: you're going to have to trust me. After the first round of questioning, Job says in verse 3 of chapter 40, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer. Even twice, and I will add nothing more.'" Job recognizes that God's right. He cannot give an answer. He doesn't know. But what God says is, "You're going to have to trust me. You're not going to fully understand everything that happens." In fact, as far as we know, Job is never told in his lifetime why what happens to him happens. God restores everything to him double. I think he would have preferred to have everything he had before without the double and the suffering. But it makes a point that we're not going to get a fully satisfying answer. I'm sorry to let you know that, but you will not be fully satisfied with the answer we get tonight. I don't know a fully satisfying answer for why is there suffering. But here God says is, "You're going to have to trust me." I want you to go to 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 14. Another story that illustrates this so profoundly to me. This idea of trusting God, not understanding what we really ought to do or what ought to happen, is the story of Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom. He's the one that God gives the kingdom into. He tears it out of Solomon's descendant's hand, gives him 10 tribes. But But instead of following God and worshiping God, who gave him the kingdom, he makes the idols. And he gets Israel to worship the idols. So God says, that's it. And Jeroboam's son gets sick. And he sends his wife to go talk to Ahijah, the prophet who told Jeroboam, you're going to be king. But he says, disguise yourself so he doesn't know it's you. And when she walks in, God's already told Ahijah she's coming. And he says, why have you disguised yourself, O wife of Jeroboam? Why do you pretend to be another woman? I have some harsh news for you. And he begins to say, tell her how God is going to destroy the house of Jeroboam, going to destroy his descendants, going to end his reign because of the idolatry. But he also says this in verse 12. Now arise, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child will die. When your feet enter the city, your child, your son, will die. But notice what he says in verse 13. All Israel shall mourn for him and bury him. For he alone of Jeroboam's family will come to the grave. Why? Because in him something good was found toward the Lord God of Israel in the house of Jeroboam. It's one of the most unexpected responses that you ever see in Scripture, in my opinion. God says, your son is going to die. And he is going to be mourned by all of Israel. He's going to be buried. He's going to come to the grave. Why is this? Because only in him, God has seen something good. Our initial reaction is that the child should live, that the good thing is to spare his life from the disease that he has. But God says, not in this case. In this case, the good thing is to let the child die. Why? Doesn't tell us for sure. The implication seems to be that he will get to come to his grave in peace while the rest of Jeroboam's house will not, because God sees something good in the child. Maybe it's sparing him from seeing the evil of the land. Maybe it's sparing him from the temptation to fall himself. There's all kinds of hypotheticals we might explain, but in short, God says the good thing for the child is for me to let him die. And that's what I'm going to do. And this has taught me that what I believe to be good, what I believe to be the proper thing or the best option, is not always the proper thing or the best option. And that I have to trust God to know what is good in his world. As we think on this, here's something to keep in mind as we struggle and wrestle with this question. God is the king, and he has all authority. He gets to make decisions. But did you realize that every prayer we ever ask of God has literally untold ramifications for God's future? For the future of his world? That way he answers our prayers change what future history says. And he has to take into consideration all of those things. But the way he answers my prayer, imagine if someone killed Alexander the Great's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. We wouldn't have an Alexander the Great. History will be entirely different. And yet, who is that person? We don't know. In fact, he has several of those. If one of those changes, Alexander the Great isn't born. And yet, what took that happening might be the death of an individual who would have killed that person. God considers all of those things beyond our scope of intellect, beyond our possibility to fully comprehend. And every question we ask him, every request we lay at him, he sees all of that and the implications it has for generations to the end. What is good is sometimes impossible for us to know. And we have to trust God. But go to Genesis. None of that really answers why is there suffering. Go to Genesis chapter 3. Here will be your answer. Again, it may not be very satisfactory, but this is the answer the Bible gives. Genesis chapter 3. Why is there suffering? In the first part of the chapter, mankind sins. They turn from God, and God gives a curse. And if you pick up me in verse 17, then to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God curses the ground because of sin. Why is there suffering? The short answer is because of sin. Because of mankind's choices, the universe as a whole, the earth as a whole, becomes cursed. It's interesting to me that thorns and thistles have become symbols for suffering and pain. If you look in verse 18, it says, both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. Which seems to suggest that thorns and thistles were not part of the original creation. That this is a new thing. This curse is bringing this into existence. Now, the text doesn't say that for sure. But it suggests that this is going to be part of the result. Something that we have come to know as a symbol of pain and suffering is connected to the curse God gives the world because of mankind's sin. You think about hurricanes, actually, specifically. Go to chapter 2, verse 5 and 6 of Genesis. It says, now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted, for the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground, but a mist used to rise from the earth and water the whole surface of the ground. Well, the text does not say this explicitly. The indication is that the way that God used to water the planet is this mist would rise from the ground. And that's where the water would come from. That didn't used to rain in the original creation. That's interesting to think about. What's the first time rain is mentioned, or when the first time a rainstorm happens, at least as far as our record in the Bible? Go to Genesis chapter 7 and look at verse 4. God talking to Noah says, for after 7 more days I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. I will blot out the face from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. The very first time rain is recorded in the Bible is because of sin. And God's going to use it to clean his planet. That the picture you see of the original creation did not have the suffering and the pain that we have today. That was a different world than we live in. And God cursed the world because of sin. Paul talks about this idea in Romans chapter 8. Go there. Romans chapter 8. Pick up in verse 19 with me. Romans 8, verse 19. Paul says, for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, to worthlessness, to pointlessness, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from the slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. That God subjected creation as a whole to the consequences of sin. Do you realize how unfair that kind of is? The animals didn't do anything wrong. The plants didn't do anything wrong. The rocks and trees have not done anything wrong. And yet they suffer the consequences of sin. Because God wanted to teach a lesson. He wanted to make the point that sin causes death. It causes corruption. This is what sin looks like. This is the result. In fact, if you look at verse 22, for we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. Every mammal on this planet suffers in childbirth because man's, not because they did it. Mankind's guilt is the reason God subjected them to pain. To bring forth life. It's all teaching this point that this happens when you sin. But how do we cope with it? Again, the brief answer, why is there suffering? Why is there corruption? Because of sin and evil. But how do we cope with that? Look at verse 18. And I want you to consider you saying these words. I want you to consider saying these words to someone whose brother or sister was killed last week. To someone who lost their house. To someone who has suffered immense tragedy. Verse 18, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. When you consider those tragedies, those words seem pretty audacious. Pretty bold for Paul to say. But remember who wrote them. Paul was run out of town of about every town he ever entered after becoming a Christian. He was shipwrecked 3 times. He suffered storms of God's world. He spent a day and a night at sea, floating on a piece of driftwood, apparently. He was hungry. He was cold. He was stoned and left for dead. If there's someone who understood suffering in this world, it was Paul. And yet he says, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared. They don't even compare to each other because of the glory that is to come. Yes, there are sufferings in this world, but how do we cope with that? We cope with that because God has given us hope. He's given us hope. You look at verse 19. It says again, the anxious longing of creation waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself would be set free from corruption into freedom of the glory of the children of God. That there is a hope that all of this suffering and all of the evil one day will go away. That God's people, God's children, will be freed from the evil and the suffering. And when he says that it's creation itself, I don't know if he necessarily means we're going to recreate the universe as it is. But what it does indicate is we will begin to see the good that God had made like it was in that first day. You read chapter 1 of Genesis, he says every time he makes something, it was good. We've never seen that world. Because we've only seen the world after the fall. We've only seen the world after the curse was put in place. We've never seen the world as it was originally created. We haven't seen the glory of God's creation when it's entirely good. And Paul says, wait till that moment. Wait till you see God's creation in its full glory and freedom from corruption. That glory is not worth comparing to our sufferings here. He goes on in verse 23, not only this, but we ourselves having the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for 2 things. For our adoption as sons to be brought into the family, to see that life finally sighed, and to be with the Father. The redemption of our body. That our bodies no longer ache and hurt and break down and die. That they are redeemed from the corruption. Verse 24, for in hope we have been saved. But hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. In hope we have been saved. But one more idea before we close. To make that hope possible, it took something. And to me, I think this is the greatest answer to the suffering of the world. Because most people are mad at God. Understandably so, from our perspective, mad at God for the suffering of the world. And they think, and one of the reasons they're mad at God is that they think that God is separate from the sufferings. He is distinct. He is distant and not affected by that. And yet, what did God do? Jump to Isaiah chapter 52. Isaiah chapter 52. Pick up with me in verse 14. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Jump down to chapter 53, verse 3. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And one like one from whom men hide their face, and he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. God is not some God up there who sits and watches at this, looks at the suffering of the world and says, get over it. He came and he participated in it so we could have hope to escape. Every pain that any person has ever felt, God has felt. He has experienced. And he did it on our behalf. Jesus, God, came in the flesh and lived and suffered as a human. Not just to get the experience, but so we could have the hope to escape the suffering of the world. To go to a place where the glory is so great the sufferings aren't worthy to be compared. Gary Sandusky did a lesson in Joliet this past Monday. Al and I got to be there. And we studied through 1 John. He told a story about how when his son was young, if I remember correctly, about 5, they started a new school, and this bully decided that he was going to pick on Gary's son. And so his son comes home, and this bully is beating up on him. He's kicking him. He falls all the way home, tripping him, knocking him down. Finally, he talks to the principal. The principal says, well, it's happening on school property. I can't do anything. My hands are tied. Gary says, okay, that's fine. I'll take care of it. So one day he hides in a bush outside their house. Sure enough, fourth grader's coming up. He's tripping his son, beating him, kicking him. And as they get up to the house, he jumps out of the bush. Hey, boy! That scared the fourth grader so bad, he falls down, gets up, staring at Gary, runs away, hits his mailbox, falls down again. Just getting up again, still looking at Gary, runs away, hits the neighbor's car. Getting up, still looking at Gary, hits another neighbor's car. And says that boy never bothered his son again. And someone asks, well, why did you do it? Well, tears in his eyes, he says, I'm not God. I couldn't sit by and watch my boy be tortured. And yet God did that for us. So while it does not take away the suffering, it doesn't necessarily give all the answers that might satisfy us, it helps us cope and realize God's not distant from our suffering, but present. And paid a price to give us hope to escape. And it's that hope that we are called to share with the world. Another statement this past week, telling one of the guys I studied with what I'd be preaching on. And he quoted someone, I don't remember who it was, but they said, I have a tendency to be mad at God and ask him, why aren't you doing anything about the suffering and the evil in the world? So that's kind of like Habakkuk, right? But then I know he could turn around and look at me and ask me the same question. Are we doing something about the evil and the suffering in the world? Are we acting to help people with their physical suffering, but more importantly, to give them the hope God offers? God died so we could have hope. Are we living out that hope and sharing it with others? If there's any need or any way we can help you tonight, let us know as we stand and as we sing.